It is Saturday, July 21st, 2012. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KOSP Public Radio. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. So please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. Today on Geek Speak, we'll be covering some interesting geek news and taking your calls with questions and comments about technology. The number is 1-800-655-5877. But that isn't for about a half an hour. I'll give you that information again when I invite your participation. But for now, let me welcome into the air room with me. My name is Lyle Troxell. Miles Elam, a software engineer and political junkie. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning.
Miles, what do you got for us starting out today?
I want to talk a little bit about power usage of our various gadgets, specifically the Apple ones.
Mm-hmm.
Some folks were checking out how much power and how much it would cost to use the power for an iPad or an iPhone, similar devices, for a year. And this is done by the Electric Power Research Institute and a nonprofit.
Sounds like they know what they're talking about.
Yeah, it's a nonprofit that's funded by electric utilities. And so they took an iPad, the newest one, and checked to see how much power it would take if you had normal usage over the course of a year.
Mm-hmm.
And it costs you $1.36.
That's it?
That's it.
The amount of power for a laptop for a year is $1.36. That's insane.
Now, by comparison, a 60-watt equivalent compact fluorescent bulb, $1.61.
But there's so much heat coming out of a laptop. I guess it's not as hot as a light bulb.
No, not a laptop, an iPad.
An iPad. Ah, so the iPad's lower. Well, that makes sense because it's completely battery operated. Okay, I get that.
And a desktop PC is $28.21.
Now, what did they call a year of use? Like 4 hours a day or, 20 hours a day? Because it depends on your usage, I'm assuming.
Right, but they were talking about you have to charge it fully every 2 days.
Right.
So that you're using it to such an extent that the charge goes down, so it would be dead after, a day and a half, and you have to recharge it again and then start over again. So it's a reasonable metric to go by.
Well, that's the only thing inexpensive about an iPad, I think.
And the previous versions were a little bit less power consumptive. Like the iPad one was less power consumptive than the Retina display one. And if you were to look at, for example, iPhones, they're a bit better. If you have an iPhone 4, 38 cents a year.
For power, electricity.
Yeah.
Wow.
To charge that.
That's just nothing.
Yeah.
iPhone contract is like $70 a month kind of thing, right?
Yeah. That's assuming that you were using it for its normal things like mapping and stuff like that. If you need phone, you'll probably need a second device.
Come on, you're pretty happy with your iPhone 4.
Yes, I am.
Do you have an iPhone 4S or just an iPhone 4?
Just a phone. Just a 4.
Just a 4. And what kind of case do you use?
It's a cheapo. It's the cheapest one I could get while I was waiting for my one that was mail order to come in.
Because what I've learned since I've got my phone is that the lithium batteries that are in them, the best way to deal with their battery is to keep them charged as much as possible all the time. So if you want your phone to last a long time and you have a phone that was made in the last 3 years, you want to basically, anytime you have a potential to charge it, you want to charge it.
That's most the general the battery, actually.
Most things the battery. Depends on the battery type, but laptops as well.
Like car batteries, the same thing.
Well, I don't know much about lead acid batteries for cars, but I believe
But you don't want to leave them dead for a long time.
You don't want to leave them dead.
You don't want to do it with hybrids either.
Right, but the person with the dead hybrid in his driveway speaks.
Well, that didn't have nothing to do with the battery, though.
Oh, okay.
But yeah. That's...
Didn't you get a secondary battery pack for that?
Yeah, I did.
All right, Miles is selling his Prius if you'd like.
No. It's a
long story. Won't get into that. That's for the next hour, car talk after us. But let's, I'm looking at I use my phone a lot, and because they're so expensive, I want it to last a long time. And, you know, it used to be that I think, well, I'm going to have my phone for about 3 years. Most tech that I deal with in my life, I think I'm going to have it for 3 years, and then I'll get the newer thing. That's normally what I do. I'm kind of a geeky person. But now that I've got kids, and they normally take on my electronics after I use them, I really want to maintain their durability, their use. And so it's been crucial to me to keep my phone charged as much as possible. Quite a while ago, you bought me an external USB power supply for my iPhone. So a battery, yeah. And so what I do is I charge that device, and I then plug my phone into it, and I carry it around. But that requires a secondary device and a cable that sticks out of my hip, and I don't get around to doing it enough. So I'm now, I just a couple days ago purchased a battery slash case that actually has 1,700 milliamp hours. So that basically, as my phone drains down, it'll actually be the battery pack that drains down, not my phone. My phone will be always charged, which of course is better for the battery.
Assuming you just have to carry around a big fat case.
It's fatter. It's not twice as thick as the phone. So I don't have it yet. I'll let you know.
Well, I should hope not.
But I mean, in the sense that even adding a little bit to the phone, the case does that anyway. I mean, I know a lot of people that have cases that
and
are pretty beefy.
So how can you still use it with...
It has a micro USB port, and if you plug your micro USB to your computer, you can still sync it. So you don't have to take it out of its cradle.
So not so much with the iPod and iPhone compatible accessories?
Well, it doesn't have the multi-pin connector, right? You have to take the case off to do that. It just has a USB port. And of course, that makes sense because it's charging through that device. And that means if you were using external mics or something like that, you're going to have a problem. You're going to have to take off your case every time you want to do it. I end up not doing that very often. The biggest time I'll need the case removed is when I'm doing time-lapse work and stuff like that, if it can't fit my my device that straps to my tripod. But that's enough about me. Just want to let you know that there are cases out there that add battery life, and it's better for your phone.
And in terms of durability, I totally agree with you. So you've never had your iPhone break or anything like that? The screen's just fine?
I dropped my iPhone when I about 20 days after getting the first one, right? I dropped my iPhone 4, and the screen cracked, and I didn't have a case. I have a pretty tall van for the family vehicle, and it was dropped
in my
pocket.
Fairness, at that time, you couldn't get a case.
I could not buy a case, that's right.
Because all the cases were sold out.
A little bit of an early adapter problem. And I dealt with that phone being broken for a year and a half, until my contract ran. No, and finally, when I bought a secondary phone for someone, I brought my broken one into the Apple store and said, I really want to buy a new phone for my friend here, but, you know, they break easily. And the guy finished the sale by giving me a free fix. So I tried that multiple times, but Apple finally helped me out. Should we move on to the next news story, sir?
Sure, certainly. Let's talk a little bit about voting. We've talked about voting in the past, like with electronic voting machines.
We've had a few shows about it, sure.
But this is not quite the same thing. And you wonder, like, what's voting have to do with geekiness? Well, the state of Washington is looking to enable voter registration via Facebook.
No, not okay. What?
Well, it's not so much that that's the only criteria. I mean, you still, just if you fill out a registration form, there's still verification that goes along with that. But at the same time, it's like, hey, there's an app for that.
So the thing that's, it gets my hackles right away. The idea that a private company, a membership of a private company would help you, assist you in getting your voter registration to happen quicker. But then again, that's been the case for a long time. There's clubs and stuff that help their members become voters, right? Registration. Mm-hmm. You can normally...
And most of the people who are, do have those voter registration forms are employed by some organization.
And then the second thing that hits me that I think... Oh, yeah, that would be nice, is that if we just had a political system that people were involved with as much as they are Facebook, we would have a more democratic world. I'm not saying we'd have a better world, because we have the whole founding father theory that maybe only some people should vote, which I don't even want to get into. But more people participate in the voting system if as much people participated in voting as did Facebook. Mm-hmm. So to some degree, I kind of like that idea.
And it saves money.
How does it
turns
money?
Out, it turns out that doing things electronically, not having to push the paper around, saves a county in Washington 50 cents to $2 per registration, and saves the state 25 cents per registration.
So, is this a Facebook app that the county actually made that allows you to do it. And the Facebook app is a way to integrate with Facebook so that you can have, you know, your statistics and your account kind of linked to the secondary service. All the apps you see on Facebook are actually web applications people wrote that integrate to some degree with Facebook. And they're easy to create. In fact, you can make an app for fun. It's relatively simple.
Right. You're basically linking yourself to this account. And so they're looking at Facebook to see your profile to say, like, okay, what's your name?
Right.
What's your date? Where do you live? That type of thing.
Right. That makes sense. I mean, if I've already have my information there, I'd rather not enter it again. At the same time, I like the separation. I don't know if I want the state thinking about me as a Facebook account.
Oh, I'm sorry. Let me take that back. Yes, they do check your Facebook profile. But what they're really doing is checking to see whether or not you've already registered. And when you click on the link to go to the MyVote service.
So it's like a checking service against your account saying, oh, well, there is already a Lyle Troxlitz registered in Santa Cruz. I see.
Right.
Oh, that's kind of cool.
And if you're already registered, then it can take you to their MyVote service where you can update any information, your address.
So their web service. Yeah, that's what I was hoping for. That it's like there's no reason why they wouldn't host their own website that would do these things. And so they're just using Facebook as kind of a checking system.
Right. You still need a state ID or a Washington driver's license and put in that information to verify it.
Does this mean when you vote, you have to have your ID?
When you're doing the registration.
Right. Okay. Gotcha. Cool.
Just making sure that it's a real person that matches all the data.
So one of the things I'm doing a bit of, and I mentioned this last week, we talked a little bit about the new website for GeekSpeak. I did not launch it before today's show. In fact, I haven't worked on it since before last week. That's what happens when you have three kids, I guess, and a job.
Yeah. See, that excuse is like wearing thin for both of us.
Of course it is.
Like,
but
we're going to have this done.
Yeah, except that we don't talk about much on air. So now what I'm doing is making a commitment at least to talk about every week to make some commitment.
That
to
way
the
people can know how big a slacker we are.
Slacker. But what I want to say to you, because you and I talk a lot about the type of technology we deal with,
type of technology we would be dealing with if we
had ever
got it done.
The website.
Yeah.
I have family in town. Come on. So I'm using Ruby on Rails, and Ruby is a programming language, relatively new. It's a lot like Perl if you're more of a old Perl CGI kind of person.
Yeah, and I tend to look down on them for that.
Right. Doing Perl right is what you've always joked about, right?
Well, no, Perl is fine. Ruby's all the hoity-toity new stuff. Yeah.
Miles is a big Java programmer, though, and to some degree, right, and JavaScript. And so, of course, these worlds...
And Perl back in the day.
We both started in Perl, right? Did you start in Perl? What did you start?
No, I started in Pascal, actually.
Oh, when you fell out of college?
No,
okay,
this was
moving
in high school.
Really? Okay, yeah. Cool.
And then
yeah, I started
C
Pascal
in
too,
high school
sure.
and then learned Perl. So Perl was actually my third
So then
language.
You did Java after that?
Java was...
Now, did you ever...
After Perl, now, yeah. Oh, wait, no, Java was before Perl.
I can believe
that.
No.
Perl was first.
Perl's just always there.
Yeah.
Any case, I'm doing Ruby development, and launching Ruby on Rails, the actual how to service the technology, is not as ubiquitous as PHP, which, by the way, both of us don't use very often, but know quite well, unfortunately.
Some of us know well.
One of the things that Ruby has a JRuby package, which is Ruby running in a Java virtual machine. And the reason why that's wonderful is basically its statistics, its ability to perform is really quite nice.
Well, let's back up for a second. When we say Java refers to many different things.
It's
Java
true.
Refers to the language, the syntax.
Mm-hmm.
It refers to the standard library, like how you talk to files on the file system and how do you talk to network resources and stuff like that and threading. And then there's the Java virtual machine.
Right.
And what we're talking about is the language of Ruby taking the place of the syntax of Java.
But, and running in the Java
right,
virtual machine.
Right, but the API, even though they've added on a little bit so it's more Ruby-like, is still the Java API,
right.
And it's running on the Java virtual machine.
And the benefit you get is that the Java virtual machine is quite robust. There's a lot of servers out there that actually can run Java Servlet engines. We actually run Tomcat on my laptop right now to run the site, which I mentioned last week. But the point of this book that I've just gotten from the Pragmatic Programmers, awesome publisher. It's the series is called the Facet of Ruby series, and the book is Deploying with JRuby, Deliver Scalable Web Apps Using the JVM, Java Virtual Machine. And it's by John Kuttner. I might have him in. I don't know if it's a little difficult. Edited by Brian Hogan. It's a little difficult to talk about programming large extents on air. We've done it over the past. But what's interesting about this is that we're merging our two worlds to some degree, Miles. The GeekSpeak server, as I launch it, will have a Java runtime environment running Ruby. And it's really because of performance. performance. The allows you to do some things from it. I won't get too technical into it. But if you're interested in this topic and you're a programmer to some degree and you'd like to participate, please feel free to get in touch with me. I'm Lyle at geekspeak.org. And also you can get to us from our website, geekspeak.org. Speaking of geekspeak.org, the old site, still there, has content from every show we've done since 2002 or something like that. It's pretty impressive, the amount of content, and I should know because I've been migrating it. But in any case, the stories we talk about today...
Slowly but surely.
The stories we're talking about today...
We still have the dad tapes from 2000, though.
That's true. We have shows that are not online, that's for sure. And you know that I don't think the database started being popular until 2004. Before that, it's flat XML files, and I don't think I'm going to import those. So anyway, we'll see. But then again,
somebody want to do some dat file conversion for us? We'd love it.
Let's go on to more news stories that will be at geekspeak.org. Miles?
So we want to fight against Islamic militantism, and we don't like Al-Qaeda. It's the general theme of... Well,
is that a Geekspeak standard States?
Not so much about Al-Qaeda. But at the same time, how do you deal with it? Now, there's one aspect that says, yeah, let's try to cut off all their communication lines and the like. But then again, you end up with the flip side of many governments will say like, well, we're gonna try to knock out Al-Qaeda. And we also want to knock out this political speech that we don't like either. And we're going to knock out this. It's a slippery slope. So what do you do about it? Well, one initiative that's underway under a program called Viral Peace is trying to combat recruitment for Al-Qaeda and similar organizations by trolling them. What will happen is they'll find an area... you know, some thread or Twitter exchange going on about militant, terrorism or terrorist cell or some recruitment type of thing. And just use logic, humor, satire, and various arguments to poke at them. Because what it does is, one, you can, for the people who are logically minded, you can start to sway them away from that argument. You can use the satire and just kind of like gets people frustrated, and you have the recruiter get flustered, and that tends to reduce the message or the effectiveness of the message.
Just filling their time with ineffective work.
Right, but it also demoralizes everyone who's trying to get involved with...
I'm thinking about participate. You know, when you participate in like an online forum about whatever your interest is, right?
Yeah.
And someone's trolling, and then there's a lot of dialogue about that troll. You're like, oh, please! It is kind of
frustrating. You have a thread about puppies. You're like, oh, I love puppies. Oh, I have this Labrador puppy. Oh, check out this puppy.
And someone says puppies taste so good.
Yeah, exactly. And then you're like, oh man, why do you always have to mess that up? The same thing happens.
And then you have the 14 people go, that's disgusting. You're like, no, quiet. Just ignore them. Please ignore
the
them.
Yeah, but you know. If you have someone who's willing to get fired up to, pick up a weapon or launch a bomb, chances are you're going to get them fired up and they're not going to be able to ignore the trolls. So I say it's a win-win.
Who's running this program of trying to troll Al-Qaeda websites? Or is it more of a theory?
There's a technical advisor to the State Department, but he's not a actual government employee. I'm sure he gets paid from time to time by the government, but he's not not a full-time government employee. And so it's basically just someone going, hey, I have this idea. Let's give that a shot. And, I say it's a great thing just because you can get the various trolls of the world out there working for a good purpose. Stop
that's
trolling puppies and start trolling Al-Qaeda.
So you're saying that's
the new slogan.
Okay, so when a troll exists, go use your time effectively and just point them over to this this news item. Awesome. Well, since you're mentioning, you mentioned the, well, okay, never mind, it's a stretch. We'll go on to your next news story, sir.
It's a stretch.
Well, you started talking about government and this concern, and I thought you were going to get into this idea that we support the idea of government attacking or defeating militists, religious militists, militarism. We support that, but at the same time, sometimes they use excuses. And so I thought you were going in that whole track of being free as a society and how the government can start stepping on those things. And I want to mention Little Brother, a book by Cory Doctorow, and his sequel, Homeland, which is about that. So it's up on geekspeak.org. Anyway, go on.
Okay. Well, to keep on that vein then, just to keep a theme going, mm-hmm. The Electronic Frontier Foundation.
Cory Doctorow, the author of the book I just mentioned, used to be the president of that, or leader of that.
Yes,
go on.
A good way to think of them is they are the ACLU for the online world.
Yes.
And what they are looking at now are these national security letters that are being used for online cybersecurity, as it were, basically contacting ISPs or like saying like, hey, we're looking at these people, but here's the national security letter, so you're not allowed to tell the customer that you are being observed by us,
right?
Or that we're getting information from you. And oh, by the way, this national security letter doesn't require a court order.
Right.
Or
it's kind of a creepiest place to be in when you get one of these.
Right.
And I know an owner of an ISP who doesn't talk to me about this, but very clearly doesn't talk to me about this, where, you know, yes, sometimes orders come through to give information about IP addresses and access and all these things, and they're not allowed, the ISP is not allowed to contact the customer, and they're not really allowed to even publicly talk about it. And it does happen, and that's pretty much all that they can say, that, yep, they know about those. They know that process. It's kind of creepy.
And so if you want to make a take on this particular issue, you can give us a call, mm-hmm. To GeekSpeak, and we can discuss it. Also, we will have links up to it on the website so that you can read more about the issue. And
well, I'll go ahead and give out the phone number since we're inviting people to call in. 1-800-655-5877. I'll give it that information again, that phone number again, in just a second. But first, let me mention that GeekSpeak on KSP is supported by the Carmel Bach Festival, a celebration of music and ideas, July 14th through July 28th, featuring over 70 events, including lectures open to the public, such as Bach in Hollywood. Full details and tickets at bachfestival.org. We are doing Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Miles Elam. In a second, he's going to give us some geek bit, a little news item that will be fun for eyes and not for ears. First, let me mention also that Cruzeo Works is supporting us. Cruzeo Works is rentable workspaces located in the heart of downtown Santa Cruz, featuring 40 new private offices, meeting rooms, an organic cafe, and 100 megabits per second Wi-Fi. More information is at cruzeo.com/CruzeoWorks or at 459-6301. The phone number is to call in with questions or comments about technology. You can ask us anything you'd like, 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Miles, geek bit?
As a matter of fact, I don't have one.
Oh, nothing?
I don't have anything that would fit the geek bit. The geek bit is supposed to be something that is visual or something that just doesn't convey over the radio. And unfortunately, all the news this week has been pretty well describable.
Yeah.
With speech.
We could make up some news that's only visual. Do you know what a lap joint is? Like a woodworking lap joint?
Oh, I was about to say like a lap joint.
You were thinking of something dirty.
No. But I was thinking of something biological.
I will make a link up to a lap joint. It's a woodworking term, and yeah, there you go.
I do have a little fun, I guess a fun bit.
Go ahead.
If it's not so much this traditional geek bit, which is all of you out there, have any of you read Isaac Asimov's Foundation series of books?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And if you haven't, I highly recommend it. Even if you are not typically a fan of sci-fi, like the Foundation series is one of those examples of great sci-fi. So you're not just stuck in the same old world of like, oh, hey, we have a laser beam and that's our plot.
these books have... lots of work have come from these ideas, or not necessarily come from those ideas, that echo these ideas through sci-fi.
Right, but one of the major themes of Isaac Asimov's work has always been the philosophical underpinnings of society. Say, yes. Where are we headed, and what are the moral questions that are involved in this. His most popular series has been about the moral quandaries of if you create robots that are largely indistinguishable from humans.
Right. When do they become sentient? When do they become an active member of
society? And when do we
have
to care about their welfare?
That's right. Right. And the laws of the three laws of robots is
popularized by the movies recently. And one thing that has come up, and this is why I brought up the Foundation series, is the concept of psychohistory. Psychohistory, according to Isaac Asimov, when he wrote these books, was a combination of psychology and data analysis from history. Mm-hmm. So you take the data of what's been going on with the population, you look at how human beings would behave, and then you plot out what the next sequence of events will be in history.
Okay.
And it doesn't work on individuals, but it does work on larger populations. Well, it turns out that some folks took the WikiLeaks data dump from Afghanistan.
Yeah.
So they have a large amount of data and an historical background, and then applied it to the behavior of large groups of people. And as it turns out, and after they did this over a course of an evening, they found that they were pretty close to what was actually happening. That you had hot spots near the Pakistani border, but not near the Iranian border. Extensive bloodshed across the main highway.
But anytime you do this kind of thing, you have to figure out what to filter in and what to filter out. It's not like you're...
Certainly.
But what's the rule set they're using to determine who gets involved in the discussion? Just that one data set? It's a large data set. The WikiLeaks data dump of Afghanistan, or the amount of data they've collected about Afghanistan, is massive.
Right.
But at the same time, it can't account for everything. Chaos theory is pretty clear about that. Really complex systems are hard to predict.
They're not talking about a specific event. They're not saying, oh, yes, and...
Yeah. I don't know. It sounds like data mining to me.
But at the same time, it's predictive. It's not just data mining.
I don't know.
It's saying, oh, well, this looks like the trend is going to be in this direction versus this direction.
I'll have to read the article, definitely.
So we'll take our time to go.
How can I find out about that article?
We're going to post it up on our website,
geekspeak.org. All right, so that's an article about predicting current affairs, which doesn't make any sense that you could predict the current based off of data sets. And this is all around, how do you get Asimov in there? With Foundation series?
Because this is this technique is reminiscent of what Asimov predicted in the Foundation series with what he called psychohistory.
I gotcha.
This is basically the same techniques.
Right, the idea that you collect tons of data and then you can predict the future based off what's going to happen.
Right.
With large
groups of people, yeah.
All right. All that information will be up at geekspeak.org. We are taking calls with questions and comments about technology. You really can ask us anything you'd like. You can ask about your computer. You want to know how to get a website up and running. You want to fix a hard drive. You want to know, should I really be back at my computer? Is password 1234, is that okay, or should I add a 5 to it? You can ask us and we'll tell you what we think. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. I say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You don't say, hey, that's my...
Hey, that's the combination of my luggage.
We're supported by Home and Small Business Tech, providing IT support to businesses and tech support for home computers. Home and Small Business Tech specializes in protecting data and have been providing data storage, recovery, virtualization, and maintenance for over 10 years. HASBtech.com. The phone number again, because we don't have any calls, which means pick up the phone and ask us. 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. Rick is in the other room waiting for your call.
Oh, wow. Aren't you bossy this morning?
Yeah, I am.
Well, let's switch gears then.
Why don't we switch gears, Miles? Go ahead.
So we've been talking about, you know, technology and politics. So let's move off. Yeah. Let's move off and go into the general science field. For example, the fact that there may be a new type of chemical bond out there that we had never seen before. I know, right?
Is this because of the Higgs boson we know about something else?
No, actually, this isn't.
Darn.
But this is theoretical physics, so, you know, a lot of hand-waving.
And math.
But it is talking about what happens when you have two molecules. Like, for example, they each have their electron cloud, and you have that weak interaction there.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, it's a fairly strong interaction, but whatever.
Go on.
But they tend to push away from one another.
Yes.
You have this interaction, but the atoms can't get that close together because of their respective shells. And but what happens if you have a lot more gravity? What happens if you have the magnetic fields that are present around a neutron star or a small white dwarf?
And dense gravity.
And dense gravity. You end up with these magnetic bonds because they have been shoved so close together.
Oh, interesting.
But it's something that we can't really experiment with here on Earth. We can only theorize that it would happen and take a look at what's happening with distant neutron stars.
Is this how strange matter works? Sorry. Star Trek reference.
To give you an idea, the strongest magnetic fields that we have created on Earth is 40 Tesla. 40 Teslas.
Okay.
And to give you a reference for that, an MRI machine will run as high as 7 Tesla. And the Earth's magnetic field is something like 25 to 65 microteslas. So how hard? How strong would this have to be to make this work?
Wait, MRI is only microteslas?
I thought they were. No, the Earth is.
The Earth is. Okay, gotcha.
No, the MRIs are 7 Tesla.
Okay.
But if you're talking about neutron stars or white dwarfs, you're talking about thousands of times greater than our strongest lab-grown magnetic field.
That's
in other words,
powerful.
Yeah, we're probably not going to be
producing
emulating that on the Earth anytime soon.
All right, cool.
But it's still fun to, you know,
theorize.
Which also brings me on to the other natural world one I'll do real quick, like, which is, and I am bringing some software in here again, but
okay.
Researchers, for the first time that I'm aware of anyway, have developed a software simulation of an entire organism.
Oh, I saw this, the amoeba thing.
Well, bacterium.
Bacterium. Yeah. So you're saying the software simulation of life emulates it perfectly in this virtual world, in the sense that every little tiny atom of it, to some degree, or its functions.
Well, no, it's not the atom of it, but the biological processes from step to step. And this is from more than 900 scientific papers to look at the model that have influenced what processes are involved. And it's not just about the DNA.
Right.
And they haven't done everything. They haven't mapped out all processes of the cell. But of what they've done, they've mapped out what we know of these cell processes and then had it actually go through.
So now, this means they could have a virtual bacterium in a virtual petri dish and actually do experiments on it.
Right. Eventually. It would just take a little while to compute it, because we're talking about, for one cell division, a single cell division, which, of course, bacteria do a lot more than one. it takes them on 128 computers.
Okay. Supercomputers, I'm
agreeing. Well, it's a supercluster, yeah. It takes about 10 hours.
To do one cell division?
To do one cell division and generates
the universe
half a gigabyte of data.
Wow. That's great.
And that's what's most interesting to me, is how much data is involved with what we consider the simplest
process. Yeah.
And so all you bio geeks out there, yeah, you guys are awesome.
Oh, that's awesome. So mitosis complicated is what you're saying.
Well, that and the fact of there is more biological DNA, more biological cells in our bodies than there are human DNA and purely human cells.
Awesome.
So,
hey, from Ben Lomond, we have Sarah. Sarah, welcome. Oh, we lost Sarah. Maybe Sarah's been moved.
She got upset about just talking about organs.
Yeah, she got upset because we're – yeah, exactly. Well, let's go ahead and jump to the next call, shall we? Hello, Sheila from Santa Cruz. Welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi. Good morning, gentlemen. How's everybody?
Good, good. What's your question today?
Okay. What have we got in the queue for citizens who need picture ID a good solid month ahead of the election?
That don't have a car.
Okay, don't have a car. And then what about this? People get bills from the gas company, they get bills from their, et cetera.
Wait, I'm confused. What are we?
I understand, it's yesterday's New York Times, there's a woman whose birth certificate had burned up. Her Social Security card was
Wait, Sheila, what's the question here? I'm sorry, I don't understand. How do you get an ID?
And technology for citizens who need picture voter ID that are not going to be able to afford $25.
This is a
political question. Yes, I understand.
Right. I get your question. So right now, to get a picture ID from the state is where you'd get it right now. You have to spend $25. That's the problem?
Do you know what the actual cost? I realize you would have to maybe look into it. You're not going to know this, but what is the actual cost of a fancy holographic ID?
Well, I don't know, but that's not the issue.
From a manufacturing standpoint,
but that's not the
bad.
The expense of that is actually not that bad. It's actually the process in place to confirm that that's the individual that has it, and that it's only one of them. And that's really what the government is charging you for with an ID, right? It's not really a technical question. Probably the print and the laminate and the hologram. You know, we're talking under $1 probably to do all that. Because you get them in mass quantity, but then you do have the county building, the people that are working there doing that. You can find out this whole process probably at a local library. You could go in there and ask exactly how much it costs.
You guys are the Geek Speak show, and sure. It's a pertinent question since they're trying to make it. One party is trying to make it inaccessible to a large part of people who are not techno to. Get their ID, to get a voter ID. Well, there is no getting around. It has to be a government agency.
Right,
correct?
But it's not just
There's
a technological
no
thing. This is a general
ID
voter
otherwise.
Registration thing. So I don't know
how.
I mean, yes, there are some technical solutions, like we were talking about the Washington State going through Facebook. But at the same time, it's a general policy question. Like, I don't believe that there's a technical solution to it.
I'd agree.
It's a policy problem. And if you try to throw a technical solution at a policy problem, you end up with bad features.
Yeah,
but
I agree.
But I feel that they're using a technical, they're making a technical moat.
I think they're making a financial moat. I don't think they're making a technical moat. The expense of the card and all that is really, like they could say, you know what, ID is free, right? The government's going to cover it under taxes, and there's going to be no cost for picture ID. The process will be completely free. Politically, I would support that because of this reason. I think everyone should be able to do this easily. But there probably is in place a way to vote without one of those IDs if you go through a process that's probably too complicated, right? So this is all a political question, not a technical one, because the technical problems that might emerge that you'd want to solve with technology. Those are interesting technical problems, but they're not the reason why that card costs a certain amount of money, and they're not the reason why you're required to use it. Those reasons are the reason is why some people can't vote potentially because they can't afford the $25. So that's a completely political thing, unfortunately, not a technical thing. But thank you for the call. I wish it were a technical solution we could wave the geek programming wand at and solve, but I don't think it is.
You know, I understand what you're saying. The only aspect of it to me that's technical is that an ID nowadays has to have holographic, you know, a state ID has to have a holographic image that is not something you're going to be able to imitate.
You know, it's interesting when you try to define technology. I'm always thinking about the terms and the ideas behind
and
it.
And that's not a technological thing?
Well, that's the question, right? So here's the thing. One term of technology that I love is technology is anything that was invented after you were 8.
Right.
So once you become 8 years old and you're kind of aware of the world, if a new thing comes around, that's technology. Anything before, that's not. So my son, who's had a round touchpad surfaces all his life, that is the interface. That is not technology. Right. It's so it really and that's true to some degree. Like a pencil is technology. It's the example I use when I teach about technology. A pencil. Right. Wood, graphite, pencil. That is an amazing technology that's transformed the world. We never think about it in the technology class, right? We don't have shows about pencils and tell them.
But the Russians used them in space while we tried to figure out a pen.
Absolutely,
that
perfect example.
That's an apocryphal story.
It is apocryphal.
That's,
I didn't
that's
know.
That's a whole other.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
But we won't get into that. But the point is that is a hologram a technical thing? Well, it's interesting technically. It's an interesting physics issue. We can definitely talk about it. I think we've had shows in the last 12 years on GeekSpeak about holograms. But it's really much more a product at this point. It's not, there's nothing fancy about it. You can copy them. You can duplicate them. It's possible. Anything's possible in art, you know, doing that kind of work. So no, because that's in there, no, it's not a technical problem. The reason why they say that you have to have a hologram in it is completely a political thing.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you for the call.
Appreciate it, gentlemen. Thank you.
Awesome call. Thank you so much.
All right. Bye.
Yeah. Holograms are harder to replicate than simply printing out something on your printer.
Yeah. But they are possible. It's possible.
That's the sole purpose for them.
Right. It's really, we see more technical complexities in identification because of the technical solutions to the fraud potentials, mm-hmm. right? You can pretty easily print an extremely realistic $100 bill. You have to get the right paper. Then you also have to have the paper infused with it gets more complicated, not because of the image.
The ink has to be the right
type. It used to be the detail of the plate was the thing. Right. It's just not that anymore because we can scan them and we can print them. Well, scanning's a little harder, but let's go on to Mark in Monterey. Welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
You talked about the Facebook used for registration and voting. Yeah. How do they verify the person's real?
They use traditional means.
Yeah, you have to
make a Facebook page.
No, you have to put in your driver's license number or some other state ID.
Oh, then they're really using that.
Yeah. The Facebook's really just a vehicle for communication.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's just a way to avoid having to do the paper chase of trying to get voter registration out there. It just becomes, hey, this is on Facebook. Click on this link. Okay.
Yeah, it just spreads that ability a little bit better. And the big thing it's doing, of course, is linking potentially, if you already have registered somewhere, your Facebook account with you, so you can support you to find out where you're going to go to vote.
Yeah, that and when you have someone, a potential use of this would be someone clicks on it and they bind their Facebook account to the voter registration to be able to have the application have access to it. Then it could go through your list of friends, look to see who else is in that area of Washington, and then
prompt you to help them to
right exactly. Just like you would.
It's interesting because it feels horrible and creepy, and I don't like it at all. At the same time, if it gets more people to pay attention to the political system, that's a good thing.
I was actually thinking if it already exists, I'd much rather have someone spam me on Facebook with, hey, have you registered today? Then, hey, I did this score on Angry Birds. What are you going to do?
Yeah. Look, I made breakfast, that kind of thing. Michael, what's up? I'm sorry, Mark, what's your question?
My main question, though, was what methods do you know of that they have got in line or they're thinking of for survival on Mars, since it doesn't have a magnetic field, no protection against cosmic rays?
Yeah, I think it's one of the big reasons. I think robots is the solution at this point.
Well, yeah, that's one of the big questions that people have there. But you're talking about manned missions.
Yeah.
And
let's break down what the problem is. So we have a great magnetosphere, speaking of our weak magnetic sphere around Earth. But what it does is it takes a lot of radiation that would be very harmful to us and diverts it away from the surface of the Earth. And actually, we have more activity of it pouring through the pole areas. It's one of the reasons why we have aurora borealis, right? And that stuff, when you're not close to the Earth, is really damaging to your skin, cancer-causing, right? Damage to your body.
It's not just on Mars, but it's anywhere out in space.
Right. In fact, all our space stations are orbiting and they're still protected by Earth. So it's really once you leave the magnetosphere, and Mars doesn't have one, unfortunately, magnetosphere. So
asteroids don't. I mean, are they thinking of the ship is strong enough?
One of the problems with the ship, though, is that one way that you would be able to block this is you have very thick sheets of lead, but lead is very heavy. To get them up into space, that becomes a
this is the main talking point of saying don't send humans into space outside the
orbit. As Buzz Aldrin actually came out saying that he thought we shouldn't treat it as a two-way trip.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That it should be, people are going out and you're going to go to Mars and you're going to live the rest of your life
but
there.
But that doesn't solve the problem of living on Mars.
Well, it does in some sense. Let's say the rest of your life is only 15 years because you will almost certainly get cancer and die. Will people still go? Probably. We just have an abhorsion to that. We don't like the idea of going on suicide missions, what we always claim it. But I bet right now if you said, hey, we're going to send you to Mars, you're going to be exposed, we'll try to protect you to some degree, there'll be water there, and if you can get under the water deep enough, you'll be set.
And people will name high schools after you.
And you'll be a hero. Do you want to do it? And a lot of people would say yes. Now, I don't know if we want those people representing our space travel, because that's a little crazy to some degree.
I mean, there are a lot of
But then again, adventurers have always been crazy. That's the point of the exploration, the adventure. They are doing something that's dangerous that the people that have the families that stay at home go, I wouldn't do that. But there are people that would.
I know about the one-way trip, but I was wondering about the moving of the planetary culture out into space.
Right. There is potential to... So first off, there is organisms that are more immune to this kind of radiation, right, that don't get damaged, don't get cancer. They're more simpler mechanisms. So as we progress as a society and get more technically savvy, we might be able to modify life forms to be able to survive it. The other way to do it is you start generating shields. You either get large pieces of lead up there or other dense materials.
Or you find some asteroids.
What?
Spin some iron very fast and make a neuromagnetic field.
Right, you potentially make large magnetic fields where people are. There's, you know, the stories that you see in sci-fi, of course, has really great solutions for these kind of things. Sometimes you can detect the radiation before it happens. I love the series Red Mars, Green Mars, Blue Mars, and I'm blanking on its name. Stevenson, right?
No.
Oh, I'll look up in a second, which talks a little bit about this. It's a very realistic science fiction series about maintaining a civilization on Mars.
So they generate a field in that book?
Well, in that book, they just have a very large ship that they've created, and in the center of that ship is it's more protected, and so people kind of congregate there whenever there's a burst from the sun. But the general idea is there is some shielding. You always are thinking about it. And then in the Mars environment, you actually make underground dwellings.
Oh. And it's... Kim Stanley Robinson.
Thank you, Robinson. Kim Stanley Robinson. Great guy. Met him once, loved him.
So when they see a solar flare coming, they run for the storm shelter.
Right, to minimize the amount of radiation. As soon as you see the solar flare, you've got some radiation happening. You're just trying to deal with the minimization. But it would be much more dangerous to be in space than here on Earth because of the radiation aspect.
Robots.
That's what everybody says. Let's just do robots. But of course, people that... we respect, like Armstrong. Is it Armstrong that said this, or who is it?
Ed Aldrin
says, yeah, we need to go as human beings. We need the skin touching the stuff. You know, we need the eyes.
You rely on robots, you take away all the romance.
Yeah.
Right. And you also have folks like Stephen Hawking saying, yeah, we either go out into the stars or we die when the next asteroid hits.
Right. We will have to do it eventually.
But okay. If we want to survive. If we don't want to survive, we can just, you know, stick around.
And I think that there will be adventurers, pioneers, people that go out and do it, and they will be horribly, horribly dangerous for them to do so.
Yes, and just like early exploration was 50,000 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't carry limes with them all the time. You know, that's why it's called... Well, anyway, we'll go on.
Okay, good.
Thank you so much for calling.
That was only 500 years ago.
Oh, okay,
yeah.
Okay. Let's go ahead and go to Seaside now. To Michael, welcome.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Good. What's your question?
So mine's a software question. I'm actually a biology major at Cal State Monterey Bay, and I've been trying to get myself some exposure to different software used by bioinformaticists.
Yeah.
And so you guys are familiar with that, I'm sure. So.
Well, we understand that.
Go ahead. So I've heard recommendations from people, since I don't have a programming background, I've heard people say, well, you might want to avoid C++ or things of that nature and maybe go towards Python or even Perl, which is like computer programming for biologists. I was just wondering what you guys recommend.
I would agree that you shouldn't go with C++, at least if you're really not interested in going toward a programming background. Mm-hmm. It's just going to frustrate you because there are a whole lot of pitfalls there. It has its uses, but it's not for the casual tinkerer.
But this brings up a topic for me that's quite close to my heart, and it's a topic I've talked a lot with my friend Warren Sack, who's a faculty member at UCSC. And the general idea is that every one of these disciplines of research at this point that are doing research is using computers, right? That's just part of the situation. Bioinformatics wouldn't exist without massive use of computers. So the question is, at what level, to be a good scientist nowadays, at what level of programming how much of a programmer do you need to be? This idea that the language of your research is in statistical analysis, is in applications, is in algorithms. And to some degree, you have to become expert in the algorithms for you to be a good scientist. And this discussion is a continual ongoing thing.
Right.
So your question
but not
is...
but not the language. Yeah, the algorithm is very important.
I would argue that the language is important too. And in the sense that a language, the way a language is written determines what you can say and what you can do. And therefore, around a certain domain like bioinformatics, there is a certain set of language, and a programming language of a certain type will be better for that language. In fact, a computer programming designed around bioinformatics would be the best language to use. So But I agree what you're saying, Miles, is don't pick a programming language that exists and say, is this the right one? What you want to look at is who is doing interesting research in bioinformatics and what are they doing, and then continue their work. I mean, that's really how it would work.
And final answer to your question, if you wanted a specific recommendation, yes, I would say Python.
I would say Python too. that's the simple answer?
Yeah.
Python. And the reason is it's an amazingly good programming language. It's being used a lot in research, and it seems to be what people are using for this kind of statistical glue environment, if you will. Mm-hmm.
And what I would also recommend is as you get better, like for example with Python, you start making these projects and you end up, if everything works out correctly, you're fine. If you end up with some job that needs to take 2 days to finish, you know, or something like that, where it's taking so long just to get back that result, and then you're like, oh, okay, I need to start it all over again. That's an area where I think you should not necessarily be the programmer. I think you should actually do a cross-discipline collaboration with a computer scientist.
I think it's more complicated than that. But let me
but
say
I'm talking
that,
about like if you're just if you have the algorithm saying, made and you need someone right. to optimize there.
Yeah.
Because that and, I think is a
let
way
me,
to go.
Let me put another aspect of the way to find out what programming environment to use is to find out who's doing bioinformatics and figure out what they're doing and continue with the work from them. But if you want to transform the field, become a computer science masters. Then go back into the field and try to improve it. Like that's what's going to happen is that as these domains enlarge in their understanding of as the their understanding of bioinformatics increases, you will see systems that are created simply to answer the questions in bioinformatics. That is going to occur, and these are algorithms and these are languages to talk about bioinformatics. It's a very complicated topic. But let's back up for a second and just let me tell you real quick that Miles and I are programmers because we program to some degree, right? Though I mentioned Ruby and he does Java, sometimes we go through JavaScript. A programmer is someone that knows lots of languages and picks up new languages when necessary. It's kind of an essential part of that brain. So to some degree, if you want to become a better programmer and understand designing systems and computers, any language and continue to learn new languages is the way to do it. How do you think about that, Miles?
Yeah, I would agree, but I also think Python's a great first language.
I think Python's an awesome first. In fact, right now I would recommend either JavaScript or Python as your first language. JavaScript because it's extremely accessible to start coding and playing with right away because you already have
it's
a really strong.
It's intensely practical. Yeah,
it's intensely practical. Python's a little more complicated, but I think it's easy. Development packages everywhere, and yeah. So there you go. Is that answering your question at all? Michael?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I do want to, I think there is some utility in learning multiple languages if you want to, I guess, kind of integrate the science field, early biology and stuff like that.
So I definitely
appreciate
agree.
It. Yeah, thank you guys. I appreciate your
Well,
help.
Thank you, Michael. And do, you know, anybody at this point, I just want to say one more thing on this topic before I say goodbye to you completely. Anyone in this day and age should learn how to program like anyone should learn how to read. That's where I'm standing at this point, is that we are in a society that's defined and controlled and understood by algorithms. And unless you start understanding that space to some degree, you don't really understand how the world works. And Miles would disagree.
I have to say that
Michael,
I disagree.
Thank you so much for the call.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Okay, you have 40 seconds. Go ahead.
Believe that everyone should learn logic and logical reasoning.
Mm-hmm.
I think that programming is an excellent way to do that, that keeps people engaged. But I don't believe that programming in and of itself should be the end result.
But aren't you the priest at the church saying you don't need to learn Latin, you just need to learn what I'm saying to you?
Sorry, what?
So way back in the day, only the priests could read. They'd read Latin. They understood the Bible.
But those
people had extreme power because everybody else had to get the information from them. You're a programmer, and in the world where programming algorithms define how things work, you are very powerful.
Right, but I'm talking about logic. I'm talking about that is the language that people should learn, not the individual dialect, which
it's
is
not,
the programming language.
I don't think the dialect of a programming language is... I don't think that's the individual nugget. I think that every domain is controlled by a certain type of programming language to some degree.
Well, this is a topic for another show.
It also obviously is. This is coming up next is Car Talk, and Car Talk on KOSP is made possible by a grant from the Burger on the corner of Bay and Mission Streets in Westside Santa Cruz, featuring gourmet burgers made with California grass-fed beef and 50 craft beers on tap. Burger's menu also includes wood-fried pizza, specialty salads, and milkshakes. Hours, menus, and event listings at burgersantacruz.com. My name is Lyle Troxell. This has been Geek Speak. In the air with me is Mr. Miles Elam.